My name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Our family's name is indelibly written upon the pages of German history. Among my ancestors are renowned historians, judges, artists. My father was the head of the School of Psychology and Neurology at the University of Breslau and also in Berlin. This meant that my father had the same position and status in Germany that Sigmund Freud had in Austria. At a very young age, I learned of the religious and intellectual heritage that is ours and of which we are guardians. My father's name was Karl. Mother's name was Paula. My twin sister Sabina and I were the sixth and seventh children born to them. They had four boys and four girls. One of the boys lost his life in World War I. I still remember the large and lavish house that we lived in Breslau, where we always had lots of hired help. My mother did not believe that one should give one's children at a young age to someone else to teach. They're far too precious. So she would teach us herself. And this will enable us to take whole years off of school, and we could still compete in the state's final examinations. I remember one time when Mother was training Klaus, my brother, how to swim. He was afraid, and so Mother tried to teach him not to be afraid, and so she simply jumped in the deep end of the pool. And my mother didn't know how to swim, but that's the kind of woman she was. She told us that it was more forgivable to make a mistake than it was to be bored. She knew how to live. We had a wonderful family life. Later on, when I was a student, I would write to my sister that I never really learned to understand other people because our family was so close and so secure. I was 6 years old when we moved to Berlin. I loved to play games. I was highly competitive. I loved tennis, volleyball, and I also liked to fight. But I never could beat my brothers. They seemed to excel in just about everything that I did. There were two things I could excel in. I learned I could excel in music and theology. Our family never went to church, not even on Easter. All of us were baptized, and the children all went to confirmation class. Our mother would read Bible stories to us. We had grace at every meal, and in the evening we'd have evening prayers. This and the confirmation class made its impact upon me, and so I announced to the family that I wanted to be a theologian. My brothers and sisters laughed at me and warned me that I would be sorry devoting myself to a poor, feeble, boring, petty bourgeois institution. I told them in that case I would reform the church. Those were difficult times after World War I. The injustice of the Treaty of Versailles, runaway inflation. My father had a life insurance policy for 100,000 marks that he'd been paying on all of his life. And when it matured, he bought 1 pound of strawberries with 100,000 marks, his life savings. Inflation did not hurt my family as much as it did others because my father had foreign clients and they paid him in foreign currency. So he was able to send me on to college. I went to the University of Tübingen, where he had gone to school, for a couple of semesters, and then I went down to Rome with Klaus, my brother, where we studied together, and I came away with a deep respect for the Roman Church. We came back to Berlin, and the University of Berlin would be my alma mater. I would be graduated summa cum laude. When I was 19 years of age and still doing my undergraduate work, it was recommended that I begin my doctoral dissertation. It took me 18 months to do it. It would be printed and known as Sanctorum Communum, in which I would deal with a concept of how Christ appears to us in the midst of a band of persons. He appears to us as community. It received little notice. No one would pay any attention to my writing. To gain church experience, I took my first assignment as an assistant minister in Barcelona, Spain. What a contrast between Berlin and Barcelona. No longer was I in the academic community with the lavish surroundings of my home. Klaus wrote to my mother and described the apartment where I lived. He said the lavatory in it was no different than that in a third-class train, except that it didn't shake. And I was shocked at the church in Spain. The Roman Catholic priests looked like they stepped out of an El Greco painting. Life was dreary and drab. There was one thing, though, that gave life zest there, and that was the bullfights. I confess, I loved them. I could understand its meaning in that kind of setting. I preached my first sermon in Barcelona. I remember in some of the sermons there was a sense of nationalism and pride in my heritage and my people. I spoke of a God that was eternally strong and young. I gave some lectures, worked with youth groups, developed a Sunday school. But then I went back to Berlin to prepare for my ordination and also to begin working on a lectureship at the University of Berlin. I wasn't old enough to be ordained yet. You had to be 25. But during that brief period in Berlin, I would print another book. I hoped it would help me to earn my lectureship. It was then that I was offered the opportunity to go to the United States of America and to study at Union Theological School in New York City. Here was my opportunity to add an ecumenical dimension to my education. I was eager to go. I studied English and finally was on my way to New York. I found it there were some difficult things in America to adapt to. They were different than the way we did it in Germany. One of the hard things I had to adapt to was the American students had the habit of leaving all their doors open. Now, how can one study when all the doors of the dormitory are open? People just walk in and out of your room anytime they want to. American ministers may be better prepared in terms of life, but they don't learn theology. I studied with some of the great teachers in America, Reinhold Niebuhr, Harry Emerson Fosdick, Ralph Sockman. They were my teachers. And so were the blacks in Harlem. I worked with the NAACP there. It was 1930, in the time of the American Depression. I was impressed to see the church there feeding hungry people. Among my most prized possessions when I returned from America were the gramophone recordings of Negro spirituals. When I was in America, I was also impressed by a man named Lasserre, a Frenchman who was a pacifist. I had never met a pacifist that I had admired, but this man was different. He was committed to Christ. The seeds of pacifism were now sown in my life. The Germany I returned to was a different Germany than the one I had left a year before. The right-wing movement was becoming stronger. For the next 2 years, I worked in a church with a catechism class teaching children the faith. I was convinced that if we could not take the teachings of Karl Barth and teach them in toto to children, then the teachings were worthless. I was also ordained during those 2 years, and I also became a secretary for the World Alliance of Churches, one of the three student secretaries in Europe, so I would travel a great deal. Usually I don't take any stock in anything that the church does that it's only for itself, but the World Alliance of Churches is an exception. It is a forerunner to what people will call the World Council of Churches. I also, at this time, began lecturing at the University of Berlin in the School of Theology. There were 1,000 students there. I'm sorry to say that about 90% of the students in theology in Germany at that time wore swastika armbands. But my class did not wear the swastika. They became known as Bonhoeffer's Circle. We would go to plays and operas together. My lecture notes have been destroyed, except for one series that I had printed under the name Creation and Fall. But some of the students kept notes that will be extant in your time. In the class, I taught a lot about pacifism and avoiding the coming war into which Hitler was bringing us. I spoke about keeping Christianity simple. If it gets complex, then people would reflect upon the faith rather than act upon the faith. It was during that period of time that a significant change took place in my personal life. I didn't talk about it, but people noticed the change. I never talked about it because I don't care for pious Christian people telling other people about their conversions. It was only years later that I wrote to a girlfriend about it. I told her that for the first time I really discovered the Bible when I was studying the Sermon on the Mount. It was a liberating experience for me. I realized I had been using Jesus Christ for my own purposes. A significant change happened in my life. I became more committed to the pacifist cause. I became more committed to the church. Up until that time, I rarely attended church. When I was at Union, I never even went to chapel, but now church attendance would be regular for me. I'd be committed to the Bible and committed to prayer. I had not even been praying regularly before. I now felt I had a call from God. And that call was to strengthen the church in its ministry. I wrote, "My calling is quite clear to me. What God will make of it, I do not know. I must follow the path. I believe its nobility will become plain to us only in coming times and events. If only we can hold out." Hitler came into power on January 30th, 1933. He blamed all the troubles of our country on the communists and the Jews. At first, it was simply telling us that 90% of the banks were run by the Jews. The Jews were infiltrating the church. They were taking over our country. Hitler claimed he was going to be the protector of the church that was the great basis of our German morality. He was going to save the church. He began restrictive measures against the Jews and communists. I wish I could tell you that I courageously stood up at the very beginning and spoke out against Hitler and against his stands against the Jews. But I didn't. My brother-in-law was a Christian, but his father was a full Jew. And when his father died, he asked me to do the service. My superiors told me that this was not the time for a Christian minister to be doing a service for a Jew. I turned him down. I'm ashamed of it. I apologized later to him and vowed never again to turn my back on a people in need. The church is to be the voice of the voiceless. The church must speak to the issues of the world. I would become very involved. I spoke on the radio. The station went dead before my talk was through. When Hitler's men ruled the state church, I called upon ministers to quit their offices, to refuse to do funerals. Then Hitler kept expanding upon his oppression of the Jews. Most of the church said to us, "Don't move too fast. You'd be ill-advised to protest now." Ill-advised? I'll tell you what's ill-advised. It's ill-advised to go against your conscience. It's ill-advised to go against what you believe to be God's truth. And I'm certain of that. Anyone who doesn't cry out for the Jews has no right to sing the Gregorian chant. If any kind of state brings too little law and order or too much law and order, it is the task of the church to be there to bind up the wounds of the victims who are run over by the wheels of the state. But the church must also be willing to put a spoke into that wheel and stop it. I really didn't know then what that would eventually mean for me. Martin Niemöller and I drew up some guidelines for a confessing church to be in opposition to Hitler's Reich Church. A number of pastors became known as confessing pastors. We opposed Hitler's control, but we spoke too little about the issues. I wanted them to speak out against all of the oppression of the Jews. But about the only time the confessing church spoke out was when Hitler said that we could no longer baptize people of Jewish descent in the Christian church. Hitler's pressure increased. University professors were fired. Paul Tillich was fired and had to leave the country. Refugees fled out of Germany. I was invited to be pastor of two German parishes in London, England, who were receiving refugees. I was in London as a pastor for 2 years, from 1933 to 1935. But I would remain busy with a confessing church in Germany, prodding, pushing it where I could, and calling for it to make its stand. My phone bill was so large that the phone company in England gave me a special discount. I traveled back and forth to Germany, England regularly. My major effort, though, at this time would be with the World Alliance of Churches. How different history could have been had the rest of the churches in the world gathered together and collectively recognized the confessing church instead of the Reich Church, and said to the world, "This confessing church is the Church of Christ in Germany now, not the Reich Church of Hitler's." But they wouldn't do it. "We cannot get involved in the internal affairs of Germany," they said. "Both churches claim Jesus Christ as their Lord. We will not make judgment on this." Bishop Bell of the Anglican Church in England made a courageous stand for us, trying to get the churches to recognize only the confessing church. But it didn't work. I had always dreamed of going to India. And now Gandhi had invited me to come and be with him. I wanted to learn of his methods and his ways. I wanted to learn of the ashram, the community that he built, because I was convinced that Christ is revealed in the midst of community. In a letter I wrote to my grandmother of my plans to go to India, I said that Western Christianity is crumbling and will no longer be in the form as we have known it. It appears to me that the paganism of the East has more Christianity in it than is in the Reich Church in Germany. Christianity came out of the East. We have westernized it and put cultural thought on it so that we've almost lost it. I have no hope that the Confessing Church of Germany will adequately oppose Hitler. I would have gone to India, except the Confessing Church called me back home to Germany to head a seminary. They were setting up their own seminaries in opposition to Hitler's seminaries. We would train our own pastors. I was only 29 years old, not much older than the students I'd be training. But I went back to start our first seminary, which was at Zingst. I was now going to create my own ashram. Zingst was up on the Baltic coast. We began in April 1935. We were there for just a couple of months, and then we moved to Finkenwalde, which is in the Pomeranian backwoods area near Stettin. There we had a large old house. There were 23 students when we first met. One of them was a student named Eberhard Bethke, who had become my closest friend in life. Our task with these students was to prepare them for the ministry, whatever form it would take in Hitler's Germany. Theological education up to that time had been an academic affair, but here at Finkenwalde, we would teach them how to read the Bible and how to pray, how to be pastors. Apostolic succession is not something that makes the church. It is its conformity to the Scriptures. I wrote a book at that time on the Sermon on the Mount and called it The Cost of Discipleship. I cried out against the cheap grace that the church was dispensing to people. I called upon us to be obedient to Christ. Obedience to Christ comes first. Faith follows. The church too often gets them the other way around. Our day at Finkenwalde was very disciplined. Early in the morning, we'd spend a long time on meditation, usually a half hour just on one little section of Scripture. And the students rebelled from this, but I insisted, and later, when they spent months and even years in prison, they thanked me for it. We became a family together. We not only studied and worked together, we played together. We played volleyball, we took long hikes. I recall the evenings when we'd sit around and talk with each other and play the old gramophone recordings and sing the Negro spirituals. This was my family. I'd had a girlfriend, but this was the time I broke with her. For these students were my family, and to them I gave my total self. The Gestapo closed our doors in 1937. They would have earlier, except in 1936 was the Summer Olympics, and Hitler wanted to give everyone the opinion that there was a religious freedom in Germany. In 1936, the New York World Telegram printed, "Thank heaven for Adolf Hitler, who has given us a front line of defense against the Antichrist communism." The Gestapo closed our doors, but that didn't stop us. Actually, I can thank the Gestapo, because if they hadn't closed us, I would never have written Life Together, which became my widest read book, which tells about our experiences in the seminary and our daily disciplines. Eberhard and I became assistant ministers in the rural areas in Pomerania, and the students who wanted to study with us simply became pastors in learning in the different churches. We kept right on teaching. We kept right on training them. By the end of 1937, 27 of our students were in prison. I printed a circular letter for every one of the students who ever came to Finkenwalde, urging them to keep the faith. If you've been in 12 different churches and have been thrown out of every one of them and are now at the 13th, thank God for it, because you're actually preaching in 13 churches. You are preaching clearly and eloquently in your absence by the very fact of your being cast out, by your cross, by your innocence. Then Hitler forbid us to use a printing press or to do duplicating of any kind, but that didn't stop us. I would now write individual letters to every one of them. They forbid the confessing church ever to take an offering. They made it impossible for a person to be a pastor of a confessing church and not break the law. In 1938, they required every minister to take an oath of allegiance. I swear my allegiance to Adolf Hitler, the Führer of the German people, and to the German Reich, to be obedient to all of his laws. Most of the ministers signed it. Those who didn't would be called into the army and sent to the front lines. Some of our young men were proud to be called into the army. They still loved their nation. This gave them an opportunity to show that they were loyal to Germany, but they were just opposed to Hitler and Nazism. There were 150 young men who went through our seminaries, and 80 of them lost their lives on the front line. They were my family. I wrote letters to every one of the parents of the deceased. At the end of the war, one of the parents had 25 letters from me. The only way I was able to escape being called up at that time was that I had influential family members who had different positions in government, and I averted arrest. I was called to come to the Union Theological School to teach in New York City in 1939. It was a means for me to escape Germany. So I came to America. Had I stayed, perhaps I would still be here today. But I couldn't stay. I only stayed 1 month. My friends, my family, all of them back there. I had a religious, a historic, an intellectual heritage of which I was a guardian. I had to go back and participate in the suffering of the Christian people in Germany if I was going to have any voice and say in the reconstruction after the war. So I went back. What happened after I went back may shock you. It was a radical change for me. I became a part of military intelligence for the Nazis. A number of leaders in the German army and other key places in government had opposed Hitler all of the time. General Beck, who was chief of staff, refused to take Hitler's orders, resigned his job, saying, "There's a time when a military person cannot take orders. He has a higher obligation and responsibility." I became a part of a small group of people in Berlin that included Beck, included two of my brother-in-laws, Rudiger Schleicher and also Hans Danagny. Danagny had been a Supreme Court justice, and he was now working for military intelligence under Colonel Oster. And Colonel Oster was under Admiral Canaris, one of our naval heroes, who was the head of all of our military intelligence department. Now, all of these people that I've just named were in opposition to Hitler. If they spoke out as Beck had done, they would have been removed from their positions. We were going to do battle with the lion in his cage, and therefore we needed to get a foothold before revealing our position. I became a counter-spy. Outwardly, I gave allegiance to Hitler and Nazism, but I worked internally for its defeat. I remember one day when Eberhard and I were sitting at a sidewalk cafe and the word came over the radio that France had fallen. People stood up and rejoiced and started singing Deutschland über alles. And they raised their hands in the Hitler salute. I raised mine and I sang. Eberhard wasn't even going to stand up. I said, "Stand up, don't be crazy. There are more important things to risk our lives for than a salute." Our first plan was to arrest Hitler and have Beck take over the government. We had the leaders of the German army behind us. We were all set. We sent emissaries to Rome. I became the spokesman who went to Switzerland and to Sweden to negotiate with the Allies. What we wanted was a promise from England and from Russia not to take advantage during the changeover. We asked them that when we overthrew Hitler, to stop military operations against us, and for them to recognize the injustice of the Treaty of Versailles. They all said no. Churchill and Eden were convinced that the English had to envision all Germans as evil. They refused to recognize that there were two Germanys, Hitler's and another one at the same time. Bishop Bell pled on the floor of the Parliament for England to recognize that there is a whole part of Germany that did not want Hitler. Bishop Bell had been in line to become the Archbishop of Canterbury. He lost that opportunity because he was now called the German lover. Our movement grew weaker. Some leaders insisted upon support from outside of Germany before they would be willing to act. Hitler gave orders that no German soldier would be punished for anything he did to any Russian. And so our general in Poland spoke out against this. He was removed. More generals spoke out against what Hitler was doing, and they were removed from office. And as they left, months of work was lost. We lost people in key places. Now it began to be clear that the only way we could ever put a spoke in the wheel was to kill Hitler. I don't try to justify this. You will know little of what I've written about it, for my diary was destroyed for this period. But you will know that we had one overriding passion, and that was the future of civilization. We must destroy Hitler regardless of personal consequences to us. 3 days after Bishop Bell gave his speech in Parliament, the plane that Hitler was riding on was supposed to blow up. But the fuse didn't ignite. They never even knew we planned it. 4 days later, one of our majors went into a munitions factory where Hitler was supposed to be. He had bombs planted all around his body, and the major was going to blow himself up in the whole factory in order to destroy Hitler. But Hitler's itinerary was changed. A week later, the Gestapo came to our door. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you're under arrest for conspiracy against the armed services. It was April the 5th, 1943. They didn't know everything that was going on. That's why they didn't execute me immediately. They wanted to find out what they could from me. They kept searching to try to find out what was going on. They were suspicious of a wide espionage ring. I was put in Tegel prison. I would be there for 18 months. During those 18 months, I did more writing than I had ever done before. I'd been writing a book on ethics, which I felt was my calling. I would never finish it. Eberhard would have to finish it for me. When I was working on the chapter on telling the truth, I was sitting there and lying to all the Gestapo agents in order to protect other people. Ethic books ought not to be written in ivory towers. I began dreaming of other books that I would write. I outlined these in letters I wrote to Eberhard. I sent him over 200 letters from prison. I asked him to save the letters for me so that after the war I could write the books. The notes in the letters are quite incomplete. I really wasn't interested in going over old church creeds to try to find out what was relevant from them and what wasn't. The overriding question for me was, where is Christ today? And the answer for me, he is in our midst. He is in the community. He is the man for others. I talked about a religionless Christianity, for I was discouraged by religion. Now, I mean, when I say religion, I mean the things that we do to try to work our way up to God, things that a man does to gain relationship with God. I'm not religious because I don't concentrate on religion. I want to concentrate on God in Christ. I believe that life and freedom and compassion are essential and they are important, the very core of life. But all of the religious trappings somehow must be freed from that. The church has become like a spiritual chemist shop, where the church sits back with its great, powerful God And the minister tells everyone what's wrong with them so the people can come to the chemist shop and get whatever spiritual aid they need, and the church dispenses it to them cheaply. But it's precisely our religiosity and our piety that keeps us from realizing how godless we are. We live in a godless age. We live in a godless society, a society that doesn't use God to fill the gaps of ignorance anymore. The society is godless. But let's not claim it belongs to the devil. Rather, let's thank God for the godless society, because it is in such a society that we can find God. He's not the God I preached about in Barcelona of strength, eternal, young, strong. He's a God who's weak in this world, who's tossed out of this godless world into a garbage dump and crucified. And that's where we meet him, in his weakness, in the midst of this world. And when we confront Christ, he takes us by the shoulders and turns us around and sends us out into the godless world. He is indeed the man for others. And so we are to be too. Well, these are just some of the ideas I had that I wrote to Eberhard. But I didn't spend all my time theologizing and thinking. At times I sat back, and on faith, I just accepted life where it was. I became engaged just before I went to prison to Maria Weidenmeier. It upset her mother. You see, I was in my late 30s. She was only in her late teens. She had been in my confirmation class. I loved Maria. But what an engagement. For a year, once a month, she'd come and would sit opposite each other like children in a schoolroom, and then we'd be torn apart. I kept on writing letters to her. I also wrote letters to my mother and father. I spent my time trying to cheer up the guards. They became some of my best friends. I wrote Christmas prayers for every one of the prisoners, and the guards would slip them to them illegally. One guard even wanted me to escape and made all the arrangements. My niece, Renate, whom Eberhard married, even brought the clothing for us to escape, and we were all ready to go, but July 20th, 1944 came first. You may remember that day. That was when one of our bombs finally went off, but it didn't kill Hitler. Now they discovered everything. My two brothers-in-law and Klaus were arrested. Our family was now deeply involved, and if I escaped, it would be harder on them. So I chose to stay. I soon disappeared. The family didn't know what happened to me. I was taken to the Reich offices and interrogated for 6 months, and then taken to Buchenwald, where I was kept for 2 weeks. Some of us were then put on a truck. We thought we were going to Flossenbürg, where they hang the prisoners. But the truck didn't go to Flossenbürg. It went down to Schoenberg. We stayed at a schoolhouse there. It was apparent that we were going to be freed. The war was almost over. It was April the 8th, 1945, and we had a celebration that day in that schoolhouse. They asked me to preach for them, and I preached. I preached from Isaiah, "By his stripes we are healed." And I preached from 1 Peter, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. By his great mercy we have been born anew to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." Oh, how it would be for all of us who had been captives to be free. The Gestapo came that night, and they called my name. "Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you are going to Flossenbürg." One of Hitler's last orders was to destroy all those who had had any part in the assassination attempts on his life. In the last couple of weeks of the war, Admiral Canaris, Colonel Oster, my brothers-in-law, Hans and Rudiger, my brother Klaus, and myself would all be executed. It must be hard on my parents. Well, I am here now at Flossenbürg, awaiting the hangman. I have never regretted coming back from America. As I wrote years earlier, my calling is quite clear to me. What God will make of it, I do not know. I must follow the path. I believe its nobility will become plain to us only in coming times and events. If only we can hold out. My last known words were said to an Englishman as I went on my way to my death. This is the end. For me, it is the beginning of life.